Chapter 5. Everyone Knows You Did It. The student interviews began right after school. For the kids, it had been a long day filled with class meetings and grief counseling. CPAC detectives in plain clothes had gone from classroom to classroom, encouraging kids to share tips with the investigators, anonymously if necessary. The kids stared back dully. The McCormick was a middle school, which in this town meant it covered grades 6 through 8. The building was an arrangement of plain rectangular boxes. Inside, the walls were painted thick with many layers of teal. Lori grew up in Newton and went to McCormick in the 1970s. She said the school had hardly changed, except for the illusion, as she walked down the halls, that the whole structure had shrunk. As I had told Canavan, these interviews were a contentious subject. At first, the school principal flatly refused to allow us to storm in and talk to any kid we pleased. Had the crime happened in another place, in the herb rather than the suburb, we would not have bothered to ask permission. Here, the school board and even the mayor intervened directly with Lynn Canavan to slow us down. In the end, we were allowed to talk to the kids on school grounds, but only on certain conditions. Kids who were not in Ben Rifkin's homeroom were off limits unless we had a specific reason to believe they might know something. Any student could have a parent and/or lawyer present and could end the interview at any time for any reason or no reason. Most of this was easy to concede. They were entitled to a lot of it anyway. The real point of stipulating so many rules was to send the cops a message: treat these kids with kid gloves. Which was fine, but precious time was lost while we diddled around negotiating. At 2 o'clock, Paul and I commandeered the principal's office, and together we interviewed the highest priority witnesses: the victim's close friends, a few kids who were known to walk to school through Cold Spring Park, and those who specifically requested to speak with the investigators. 2 dozen interviews were scheduled for the two of us. Other CPAC detectives would conduct interviews at the same time. Most we expected to be brief and yield nothing. We were trawling, dragging our net along the sea bottom, hoping. But something odd happened. After just 3 or 4 interviews, Paul and I had the distinct impression we were being stonewalled. At first we thought we were seeing the usual repertoire of adolescent tics and evasions: the shrugs and you-knows and whatevers, the wandering eyes. We were both fathers. We knew that walling out adults was what all teenagers did. It was the whole point of these behaviors. In itself, there was nothing suspicious about it. But as the interviews went on, we realized something more brazen and purposeful was going on. The kids' answers went too far. They were not content to say they knew nothing about the murder. They denied even knowing the victim. Ben Rifkin seemed to have had no friends at all, only acquaintances. Other kids never spoke to him, had no idea who did. These were transparent lies. Ben had not been unpopular. We already knew who most of Ben's friends were. It was a betrayal, I thought, for his buddies to disown him so quickly and completely.